be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen and Brother Mustafa. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Mohsen. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Mustafa, assalamu
alaikum. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Muhammad Baqir Behbahani, mainly known as Wahid al-Behbahani. His main struggles were against the Akhbaris on that time and his time. We'll talk more about this aspect of the life of Wahid Behbahani. But before that, let's get to his early life and his scholarly life. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Muhammad Baqir Behbahani was known as Wahid Behbahani or Wahid al-Asr. Or he was also known as the greater teacher or the Ustad Kul. Yes. Kul means like the one who knows everything. Mm-hmm. And the second Allama or Muhakkik al-Thalith, because yes, we had the Muhakkik before it. So he was the third Muhakkik. He was one of the Usuli Ulama and was against the Akhbarism, we can say. And what we see is that he was born in Isfahan, since he was Behbahani. And after that, he was one of the students of Allama Majlisi. And from his children, we can say like he had children like Muhammad Ali, who was one of the great and famous scholars in Kirmanshah. And the other son of him, Abdul Hussein, was the responsible for the financial, yes, issues of his father when he was a marja. Yes. Obviously, in the office of marja, there are different things that are obviously needs to be dealt with, especially the financial terms when the khums and zakat comes, and so on. He basically have studied his initial studies in Isfahan. And he has got the initial things, like initial, we can say, like his schooling was by his father, where he studied by his father. And after that, he went to the Najaf, where he had the teachers like Sayyid Muhammad Tabatabai Burujardi,
yes,
and the other ulama. About his students, what we can say is that he was a great scholar, that amongst his students we can take the name of Mullah Mahdi Naraqi,
yes,
Sayyid Muhammad Mahdi Tabatabai, who was known as Baharul Ulum. We had the Abu Ali Hayri, who wrote the Muntaha al-Maqal.
Yes.
Mullah Ahmad Naraqi also was known as his students, Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Isfahani, Mirza Abul Qasim Qummi, Kashiful Ghita. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the great names, basically. Yes. Who were in the Hawza of Najaf and Karbala. So these were the main, we can say, like students of Wahid Behbahani. On the other hand, we can see like he wrote the books on the fiqh. Obviously, he, yes, was a jurist. And there are 119, we can say, like the books and the articles which he wrote. And they were on different issues. And his main popularity was due to his combat with the Akhbaris.
We got to that. Let's get to Brother Mustafa and have more. We can say Wahid al-Behbahani from his tongue. Okay, Brother Mustafa, give us more information about the scholarly life of Wahid al-Behbahani, especially as Sayyid said, his approach and where does this conflict come from? I mean, Akhbaris and Usulis, disagreement in the houses, and what was the role of Wahid al-Behbahani in order to recreate a kind of new atmosphere in the houses for Akhbaris?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Behbahani spent most of his scholarly life in Behbahan, and in the house of Behbahan, there were many scholars coming from Bahrain. Mm-hmm. And those who were coming from Bahrain, mainly they were Akhbaris.
Mm-hmm.
And Muhakkik Behbahani was against Akhbarism. So he spent most of his time that he lived in Behbahan trying to fight or trying to deal with this issue of Akhbarism. And he wrote one of his famous books, Al-Ijtihad wal-Akhbar. It was a kind of defense for Ijtihad, and he wrote it in Behbahan. So, and also when he went after a while, when he traveled and settled in Karbala, Karbala was also a center for Akhbarism, yes. Especially when Sheikh Yusuf Bahrani was the great teacher and the great Shia scholar who was living there. So even there, he tried his best to clarify and somehow explain to people and the scholars that Akhbarism is not the correct way of thinking thoughts.
So the type of Ijtihadi look in the Islamic houses was over there, isn't it? So now the Akhbaris are going to negate the whole Ijtihad. Is it so? Is it done by the Akhbaris? I mean, they negate the whole, we can say, the concept of Ijtihad?
They believed, I mean, as it was explained earlier, that we have the sources of our takalif and our obligations is either Quran or is Hadith. So, but there is no reasoning, there is no istidlal and ijtihad when we are dealing with our takalif and our obligations. Mm-hmm. So if there is something written in the narrations, in a hadith and in akhbar, so we accept it. If it is not there, so there is no other way to come to a conclusion regarding an issue in religious affairs.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
So in this way, for the Akhbaris, there is no place for intellect, for aql or istidlal. Is it so?
Well, obviously, we cannot say like there is no place. They do use the intellect when when they bring a hadith and they start to argue, or the arguments on the hadith, how this hadith proves a specific rule. Mm-hmm. They're actually doing that. But obviously, they take it under the narrations. They say, we need to have a narration first to prove something, and then they do the discussion.
Okay.
Whereas the usulis, they say, in the place where we do not have any narration and the hadith and the verse of the Quran, what should we do? And there is the place of ijtihad. Ijtihad means the scholar struggles. He tries to understand through other ahadith, through the, you know, the intellectual ways that we have seen, for example, how the ulama used to do. Mm-hmm. There is the ijma of the ulama as well. It is also involved. And there are many other principles.
When we face a hadith, so there are some wordings over there by the infallibles. There is a hadith. So according to the Akhbaris, are we allowed to discuss about the hadith and do and use our intellect in order to have our own understanding? Is it so or no?
We're not doing our own understanding of the hadith. That does not mean. Mm-hmm. The mean is that what hadith has said, they need to explain in the same way. For example, hadith is talking about a specific thing. So they just talk about that specific thing and they do not go beyond that.
Okay.
Whereas the ijtihad is that where hadith is saying this, maybe it's proving something else as well.
Okay.
So they do ijtihad. Or maybe like, you know, the hadith is quite about a specific issue. Mm-hmm. So there you need to do the ijtihad. We cannot leave as a mujtahid. It is the duty of the mujtahid to not leave the muqallid, the one who's following, in a situation where he's confused. Mm-hmm. He has to take the people out of confusion.
Yes.
If he cannot take them out of the confusion through the ijtihad, then he says, for example, this is ihtiyat. Mm-hmm. For example, this is you need to refer maybe to another mujtahid or a'lam, the one who knows better than this, because I could not reach to a specific, you know, decision. On the other hand, when we look at the personality of the, you know, the scholarly personality or the social personality of Behbahani, Wahid Behbahani, it is enough to say that Allama Bahrul Ulum and Sahibul Riyadh,
yes,
they both have called him Allama.
Yes.
And Allama means a highly, you know...
a polymath is polymath. What they say, yes.
Yes. On the other hand, Sahibul Jawahir and Sheikh Ansari, they have called him Ustad Akbar or Ustad Kul,
yes,
the greater teacher. So, you know, with these personalities that we have mentioned, when they have remembered him in such a way, it means that he was a great scholar. He was, you know, the man of what he used to, you know, teach. And also on top of that, he had the akhlaqi characteristics, you know, his akhlaqi characteristics or akhlaqi, we can say, point of view. He was of the best character.
That's right.
So that such people who were the writers of, you know, the books of ethics, they were also calling him as a teacher.
Okay. And the story between Wahid Behbahani and Sheikh Yusuf Behrani is really interesting, because when he entered Karbala at that time, as you said, the Akhbaris were over there. And for 3 days, we can say
he requested.
Yeah, he requested to Behrani. Teach instead of Behrani. And since Behrani was a moderate man, he led Behbahani to do the teaching. And after 3 days, we could see that 2/3 of the students of the Akhbaris, we can say, changed their brooch into the Usuli one. Since that time onward, we can see the house of Karbala was under the shadow of Wahid Behbahani and his teachings. Okay, brother Mustafa, can you name some of his works for us? I mean, beside the other works.
Of course, Maghrib Behbahani was also a prolific author. He has many books in different fields of study, especially in fiqh and usul. In usul, he has a great book, Ar-Rasail al-Usuliyya, which discusses basically the reasons, or it brings proofs for ijtihad and istidlal. This book contains 8 treatises in Arabic, especially the first one, which is the main and the most important one, is Ar-Risalat al-Ijtihad wal-Akhbar. So
that's
in
right.
this treatise, he goes deeply and he goes profoundly regarding the issue of ijtihad and akhbar. And in some points he proves that akhbarism and akhbari school of thought is not enough and is not the perfect and the true way of thinking.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Mustafa and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, for a nice elaboration on the life of Wahid Behbahani. Yes, Wahid Behbahani passed away on Shawwal 29th, 1205, according to the Hijri lunar calendar. At the end of his life, which was a long life, 83 life, he only, we can say, taught Sharh al-Lum'a and ordered his outstanding student, Bahrul Ulum, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum, to get back to the city of Najaf and take care of the houses over there. And after he passed away, his body was taken into the city of Karbala and he was buried in the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam by the foot of the martyrs of Karbala. May Allah bless the soul of Wahid Behbahani, the reviver of the Usuli school of thought of the houses of the Elmias of the Shiite world. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen and Brother Mustafa, for a nice elaboration. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
With mounting food, energy, and housing costs, UK household budgets are becoming increasingly stretched. And as the cost of living crisis worsens, vulnerable families and their children are being pushed to the edge.
People are struggling to eat. People are struggling to heat their homes as well. That has a knock-on effect in terms of general health and well-being. So we get more people that turn up at accidents and emergency, more people that might be using drugs and alcohol to alleviate the symptoms caused by the poverty that they're feeling.
Around 13.4 million people were living in poverty in the UK between 2020 and 2021, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Analysis from the foundation has revealed 3.9 million children were living in poverty in the UK in the same period of time.
We regularly have people who come in that may not have eaten for 2-3 days. We didn't used to see that before. I also had a family where one night they fed the son, the next night they fed the daughter because they can't feed everyone. I just think it's shameful that we're in a relatively wealthy city that we have people that are struggling so much.
Child poverty increased most dramatically in the northeast of England between 2015 and 2020, rising by over a third, from 26% to 37% of all children. Demand for free school meals is also highest in the Northeast, where around 29.1% of children currently qualify, compared to just 17.6% in the Southeast.
We all know inflation's going up, you know, by a lot, but it's people that are on the lowest incomes that will suffer the most, because the products that they're buying to basic food isn't just going up by 10% or whatever, it's going up by 100%.
But while the Northeast now has the highest rate of child poverty across the regions, many of the worst affected constituencies and local authorities continue to be in London, according to Action for Children. This is due to high housing costs in the capital. The Childhood Trust has found 40% of children aged 6 to 16 are facing food poverty in London, meaning their families cannot afford to keep them fed.
In a city like London, one of the most thriving cities in the world, it's shocking. It's shocking to think that number of children and our families are struggling to make ends meet and are struggling to provide the food that they need for their families. It's really quite a shocking statistic, I think.
In the words of Lawrence Guinness, Childhood Trust Chief Executive, we've never seen levels of food insecurity at that high before. It's an alarm bell in the face of growing adversity and the diminishing power of household income. Tower Hamlets is the borough with the highest rate of child poverty after housing costs, with a rate of 51%. Child poverty rates are also high in other large cities like Birmingham and Manchester. The latest data available shows children from black and minority ethnic groups are more likely to be in poverty at 46% compared to 26% of children in white British families. Children's charities, schools, and food aid organizations are working tirelessly to plug the gaps created by the welfare system. Food banks are now being set up in schools so children have enough to eat.
Research by the Child Poverty Action Group earlier this year estimated that 1 in 3 school children living in poverty don't qualify for a free school meal. So when we talk about hunger, we're talking about children coming to school and relying on a hot, nutritious meal at lunchtime. And the figures around the 1 in 3 are sitting at around 800,000 children. And that's why we're running a campaign to extend eligibility so more families living in poverty can access good nutrition at lunchtime.
Living in poverty can have a serious impact on a child's well-being. Some report feeling ashamed and unhappy and worry about their parents. Disadvantaged children are more likely to develop severe mental health problems by age 11 than their well-off peers. Kids in inadequate housing have been shown to be more at risk of respiratory illnesses and meningitis. Those in the most disadvantaged areas can expect 20 fewer years of good health in their lives than children in places with more resources.
So when you're living in a cold, damp home, that causes huge problems. If you're in, if you've got pre-existing heart conditions, if you've got respiratory illnesses such as long COVID or COVID itself, if you've got asthma or COPD or other lung conditions, all of those things are made much, much worse by living in a cold, damp home. If you're recovering from surgery, that can take longer for your wounds to heal because you're living in a cold, damp home. So there's a whole range of different things that are affected by the problem of fuel poverty. And that's why if we don't solve these things through economic measures, we're going to see a long-term health crisis affecting our country.
On the rise alongside poverty is childhood obesity, with rates at an all-time high. Children aged 4 to 5 in the most deprived 10% of the population are 75% more likely to be overweight or obese than those in the most affluent 10%. Poverty even puts kids at greater risk of being groomed or exploited by criminal gangs. There are reports that children whose families are mired in deep poverty are stealing basic items such as food and tissues from their schools, and some are missing lessons altogether because they cannot afford the bus fare. In November last year, The Independent published a horrible report about schoolchildren and parents shoplifting to feed themselves and their families. Meanwhile, the Children's Society is warning that government support does not go far enough, as thousands of children are at risk of malnutrition this winter. Campaigners and economic experts have repeatedly called for an overhaul of the Social Security safety net, particularly reforms for universal credit and an end to the two-child limit to receiving some benefits. The 20-pound cut to universal credit in October 2021 plunged families back into poverty after giving them light relief throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. Surprisingly enough, successive conservative chancellors have reduced tax credits and benefits for low-income families with children while introducing tax cuts that have benefited the better off.
We are calling the government to increase its support in order to get through this winter. And we are also calling the government to think about enduring solutions, especially in the area of energy efficiency, in order to reduce very significantly the level of consumption of our customers.
According to The Observer, the UK has become a hostile place to have children, as parents are being forced to bring their offspring in conditions that will have grave repercussions for society. It starts even before birth. It's estimated that more than 1,000 babies die or are left with severe injuries each year as a result of something going wrong during labor. Meanwhile, the number of child abduction offenses has been on the rise. Over the past decade, nearly 10,000 children have been abducted. In one case in late January, dozens of asylum-seeking children were kidnapped by gangs from a Brighton hotel run by the Home Office in a pattern apparently being repeated across the South Coast. It has emerged that the Home Office was warned repeatedly by police that the vulnerable occupants of the hotel, asylum-seeking children, who had recently arrived in the UK without parents or carers, would be targeted by criminal networks. Child poverty in the UK is reaching worrying levels. Paltry wages, low benefit payments, and a cost of living crisis mean the UK's poorest families and their children are getting poorer. But will the UK government do something meaningful in this regard? History is not promising, but we'll have to wait and see.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. We are still talking about some of the questions and answers related to the month of Ramadan and fasting based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me ask you this as the initial question, Sheikh Javid.
Sure.
You know, some people, you know, experience bleeding in the mouth. Like, for example, when they come from the dentist, they have maybe an operation or something on their gum.
And if they do so, usually it bleeds, you know, for quite some time for them. So if there's a bleeding in the mouth of a person who fasts, does it affect their fasting? Does it invalidate their fasting or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, bleeding in the mouth does not render the fast void. It does not have any effect on the fast, provided that one makes sure that the blood does not enter his throat or does not reach his throat. So blood is impure, and one should actually prevent from the blood from reaching the throat. As long as one you know, takes care of the blood and prevents it from entering the throat, then it's not going to invalidate his fast. Otherwise, you know, if a person deliberately swallows the blood, it does render the fast void. It will make the fast void.
How about the smoking, Sheikh Javid? You know, does it really invalidate fasting? Because I've heard some smokers, they claim that smoking doesn't invalidate their fast, and so they kept on smoking when fasting.
Well, as far as I know, all the religious authorities, and there are some, of course, I don't want to name, they have forbidden smoking. There are some prominent religious authorities who have exercised precaution, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He says that based on ihtiyat wajib or obligatory precaution, one shouldn't smoke, and smoking actually invalidates the fast as a measure of obligatory precaution. So not only His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, but also some other scholars, they have forbidden smoking during fasting as a measure of obligatory precaution. You know, of course, we do know that when a religious authority exercises precaution, one has the right to choose another mujtahid or to refer to another mujtahid who has a fatwa. And if another mujtahid also exercises precaution, he does not have to go to him. Of course, he should remain following and acting upon the fatwa or the ihtiyat that his marja actually exercises.
How about the other narcotics, Sheikh Javid? You know, like, for example, opium, because they smoke it too, right?
Yeah, opium is, of course, is forbidden. And then it, you know, it's not only forbidden, but it will also affect the fast. And so, but it depends, you know, what kind of opium you mean. You know, there are, we have different kinds of, you know, drugs that some of them are swallowed, some of them are, you know, smoked. And there are, we have hashish, we have weeds, we have marijuana, and these are different forms of you know, let's say herbal drugs, which are forbidden according to religious authorities.
What about nas? Some people use nas, which is made up of tobacco and other constituents, and they put it under their tongues for a few minutes, and then they spit it out. Does that invalidate fasting?
Yeah, it is. Nas is something which is which drives from tobacco products, you know. It comes directly from tobacco, and of course, a fasting person should avoid, again, as an obligatory precaution, all kinds of tobacco products, including nas. It's something placed under the tongue or in the mouth, and it does not usually spread, and it does not go into your throat. There's no smoke, there's nothing, but it does have its effect. Narcotic, you know, it has nicotine. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Nicotine, yes.
Yeah. So many religious authorities have again exercised precaution, saying, okay, one, a fasting person must not take nas, because it's not something to be smoked. It is something placed inside the mouth, you know, under the tongue or and in a corner of your jaw. and then the smell goes into your brain, and then it will have its effect on your brain. In the event of fasting, of course, the obligatory precaution is not to take it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Mohan Jalal, the host of this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the questions and answers of jurisprudence related to fasting and the month of Ramadan. Sheikh Javed, I asked you a question related to smoking.
Yes.
But what about the smog, which is a thick smoke and fog, which happens to actually hit the towns usually because of their car pollution? You know, those people, especially who are working in the car garages or mechanic stores, they usually are very much subject to, receiving a large amount of smoke coming out of the exhaust pipe of cars. So does that invalidate their fasting?
Well, generally speaking, and, you know, the rule of thumb is that thick smoke or dust,
mm-hmm.
if swallowed, will affect the fast. It mm-hmm. will invalidate the fasting. And... But it's not established or proven that, you know, the smoke coming out of the exhaust or the smoke that is there in the city will have a negative effect on your fasting. It's not proved. It's not established, and no religious authority has ever said that the smoke, the pollution, actually will make your fast void.
Mm-hmm, I see. Just a bit, you know. Asthma patients, they need to use some sprays. And these sprays are normally puffed into their mouth in order to reach their lungs or in order to provide them with some relief when one of those asthma fits hit them, you know?
Yes.
So is it permissible for them actually to keep fasting and also use the spray?
Well, the spray comes under different names. Some people call it inhalers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some, you know, there are people who call it nozzle spray. So it's a spray at the end of the day, anyhow. And this spray, which is used to actually open the respiratory tract, does not invalidate the fast, provided that it does not. It is not in the form of a kind of fluid
mm-hmm.
That enters your the throat. Okay.
Yes.
As long as it does not enter the throat, the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have said that it does not affect your fast.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. Thank you very much, Javed. Thank you for your comments and answers to these questions of jurisprudence related to fasting in the month of Ramadan. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Wish you farewell, and please keep us in your du'as, especially when you are fasting during the month of Ramadan. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Man La Ilaha Illa Hum Ghaffar.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakah.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. We find many proofs for the great treasure of his knowledge and wisdom. One of the great proofs of the great treasure of knowledge and wisdom of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam is that while His Eminence was still in his tender youth, the Shia jurisprudence, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam, hastened towards the city of Medina. They came to inquire as to know who is the next infallible and divinely appointed Imam. The reliable people and those who were trustworthy guided these Shia jurisprudents who had come from different places in the Islamic world towards Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. The Shia jurisprudents went to Imam al-Jawad and asked His Eminence the most ambiguous and complicated of questions. And yet Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every one of them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, what an honor it is to be here talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed Imam. So, dear friends, we find that it is very interesting, but Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam speaks with one of his companions about how to really complete and finalize our work. In this discussion, we find that the companion of the Imam alayhi salam had asked His Eminence what are some things which can help them to be able to complete, finalize, and reach the peak
of their work? A very interesting question, and of course, inshallah, the answer is something that is applicable for us in our daily lives in the present day. So, for example, in response to the question, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he answers and says that four things assist man in good work. One is good health, second is wealth, third is knowledge, and fourth is success. So these four things, dear friends, according to this dialogue of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, can help us in our work and can help us in completing and perfecting and refining our work. Of course, the first one was good health. Without good health, no work can be done. Matter of fact, we should be incredibly, incredibly grateful to the Almighty Allah for giving us good health. And we don't necessarily have to go and look at people who have bad health. But even though if we do witness people whose health is not in good condition, and you find what kind of a sad situation they are in, you do realize that good health is such a wonderful and great blessing that has been bestowed upon us by the Almighty Allah. And of course, it being one of the four things that assist a person in their work. The second one, of course, is wealth. When you have wealth, you are able to undertake certain actions, you are able to undertake certain deeds and certain works that you possibly would not be able to if you didn't have that wealth. So again, wealth is something that one should be incredibly, incredibly grateful to the Almighty Allah for this wealth. For example, you can build masajids, you can build Husayniyas, you can sponsor schools, you can sponsor Muslim children, you can sponsor orphans. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. But does that mean that if we don't have wealth that we can't benefit from these things? No. If we don't have wealth, then there are many other ways in which, you know, we can benefit and gain the rewards and the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah. The third and the fourth is pretty self-explanatory, of course. Knowledge is something that does assist one in one's work. If you don't have knowledge of something, the work only becomes more difficult, if not in some cases impossible. And of course, success assists an individual in their work. When you have one success, it leads to another success, and it kind of increases your motivation, your dedication, your eagerness to do a certain task. And so indeed, if we want to be able to be successful and move forward in our career paths and in practically in any work that we do, whether it is religious or non-religious, good health, wealth, knowledge, and success will surely help us. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarat Text of Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
السلام عليك أيها النور الصافي السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالب السلام
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O Immaculate from among the Immaculate Ones. Peace be upon you, O Pleased and Pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parsday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Glorious martyrdom. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on one of the most tragic days in the history of mankind. Today, the 21st of Ramadan is the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Ali, peace upon him, the person who had no peers and whom God Almighty had made second in merits to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. A millennium and four centuries have passed since his departure from the mortal world, and yet Imam Ali, peace upon him, remains immortal for all believers who continue to pay homage to him, whatever the circumstances, including the current corona pandemic plaguing the world. He was the embodiment of justice, and this was among the causes of enmity towards him by certain people who finally conspired to martyr the person and end the only instances of the administration of social justice in history. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. It is indeed an irony of Islamic history that on the 21st of Ramadan, the second of the three probable grand nights, the grand man, Imam Ali, peace upon him, achieved martyrdom, having been struck a fatal sword blow on his head while performing the morning ritual prayer in the Grand Mosque of Kufa by a Khawarij or renegade from Islam, progenitors of modern-day Takfiri terrorists. It could be called the martyrdom of the spirit of the Holy Quran, in view of the famous statement of the Prophet, who decades earlier had foretold his dear cousin, son-in-law, and divinely designated heir of the tragedy he would suffer in Ramadan. As recorded by all prominent narrators, including Sunni and Shia, indeed, Ali is with the Quran, and the Quran is with Ali. The two will never separate, even when they return to me at the pool of Kawthar in paradise. In view of these undeniable facts, all of us ought to pray fervently for the triumph of righteousness over falsehood and the end of tyranny on planet Earth, whether by the great Satan, the U.S., or its devilish agents who are bombarding the people of Yemen, brutalizing the Bahrainis, committing untold atrocities against the people of the eastern parts of Arabia, destabilizing Iraq and Syria, pounding the Palestinians, and funding sedition in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Anyone who attempts to write something about Imam Ali, peace upon him, will admit that he was a perfect man of God, obedient to the Creator in all aspects of life, to the extent that he would not even entertain the idea of committing the minutest act of disobedience. His famous words continue to ring in our ears, despite the passing of a millennium and four centuries since his martyrdom. By Allah, even if I am given all the domains of the seven climes with all that exists under the skies, in order that I may disobey Allah to the extent of snatching one grain of barley from an ant, I would not do it. For me, the world is lighter than the leaf in the mouth of a locust that is chewing it. Imam Ali, peace upon him, was indeed a paradigm of piety and excelled all others in the worship of God, as he himself had said, "O people, I do not impel you to any obedience unless I practice it before you, and I do not make you refrain from any disobedience unless I desist from it before." He lived according to the commandments of God and in accordance with the sunnah and sirah, or practice and behavior of the Prophet. Because of his commitment to these factors, he refused to accept the caliphate after the death of the second caliph. When the condition spelled by the six-man council was that the next caliph should be bound to the behavior and pattern set by the first two caliphs. Although justice is regarded as a much cherished humanitarian principle, there are very few who really adhere to justice and practice justice. History bears witness that persons in power show respect for justice and implement justice as long as it is in their interest. Justice, in the lexicon of such persons, has definite limits. As for Imam Ali, peace upon him, justice had a transcendental meaning where self-interest ceased to exist. He was the epitome of the just ruler and spared no effort for the implementation of justice. When he heard that the agents of the rebel Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan had plundered the city of Anbar and snatched the jewelry from the women, including those non-Muslims living under the protection of Islam, he said, "If any Muslim dies of grief after all this, he's not to be blamed, but rather there is justification for him before." In another place, the Imam says, "By Allah, I would rather like to pass the night in wakefulness